Welcome to Medicus, a student-run podcast about any and all things in the world of medicine. Follow along as we interview outstanding individuals about important topics in healthcare. Hi, I'm Emily, and I am back with another episode for our MS4 Perspective series. Through this series, we interview fourth-year medical students about their specialty choices, their paths, and their advice for students interested in entering that specialty field. The specialty of focus in today's episode is urology. Every year, the urology match takes place in February, which is a bit earlier than the main NRMP match, which occurs in March. Urology applicants now know where they are headed for the next step in their medical training. I am excited to introduce the guest of today's episode, Farah Rahman. Farah is a fourth-year medical student at Loyola Stritch School of Medicine who recently matched into urology at Ochsner Medical Center in New Orleans. Farah has longstanding interests in public health and health policy and is driven to alleviate health disparities. This frame of reference has shaped her endeavors as a medical student, as well as informed her decision to apply to urology. So Farah, thank you for being here today.
Hi, Emily. Thanks so much for having me.
First, would you please tell our listeners a bit about yourself? Could you take us through your journey into medicine thus far?
Hopefully the story is not too long, but I was actually born in India and I immigrated here when I was about 3 years old. So I spent a good chunk of my childhood living in the Bronx. And then my parents and I moved to Vegas, where I lived through high school and then eventually went to UC San Diego. And at UCSD, I double majored in human biology and global health. I would say global health is my main passion. I think being a first-gen Indian-American woman and going back and forth really informed me that the world is not made equally. And as far as India goes, the family you're born into really dictates your life choices and the trajectory of your career and everything along the lines of that. And it's something that I've never taken for granted living in the United States. Moreover, the health disparities in India are just more apparent and in your face. And when you're a child, it's really jarring. So I would say my medical journey started with global health and refugee work in Amman, Jordan, where I worked for a summer with the United Nations. I think that really gave me a springboard into coming to a place like Stritch that cared for people that are beyond the patient that you see in front of you, but rather a systemic host of everything around them. That's something I really value. And if there are listeners out there that really care about public health and treating the whole person, not just a disease, I would say Stritch School of Medicine should be on your radar because it's a fantastic place to get that education.
Awesome. Thank you. And yeah, I completely agree about Stritch. It's clear that you've had a very meaningful, expansive journey into medicine. I would love now to hear more about your decision to pursue urology specifically.
Yeah, whenever someone asks me why urology, I ask them if they want the real answer or the interview answer. I think it's two sides of the same coin. And I would say on a colloquial level, I went to a urology interest group meeting back when I was a first year med student, just for the pizza, if we're being honest with ourselves. And I thought the residents speaking were fantastic. But more notably, I really was taken aback by the misconception in the room of what the field of urology is, who can be a urologist, and who they serve. And so even though we were first year medical students, already the cream of the crop, if you think about it, in the room, people thought it's a field for men, by men, meant for men. And it just really didn't sit right with me. And I was able to text some peers and be like, have you guys heard of this field? Do you think I could be a urologist? And it was a mixed opinion, but I was like, why not? And the more I shadowed, I was always welcomed by the nicest people. It was never an exclusive room where I would not be included as a medical student. And I learned there's so many facets. There's pediatric urology, urogyn, which I really liked as a woman, like trying to overcome this misconception. And there's men's health and sexual medicine. So colloquially, it's because I got to really be my full sociable and kind of bold self in a medical field, which is sometimes really dominated by hierarchy. So I thought that was unique. And then I'll keep it short, but for my interview answer, I say urology has a really great balance of whatever you're looking for. I was looking for a balance between past and present. And so urology is a newer field, but they really do revere the people of the past who made the field. And they also look forward to making the field more diverse. This year's match had so many classes of all women. I'd like to take a second to shout out Ashna Urology for matching a full class of females. I'm extremely excited about that. The other parts of balance are clinic and surgery. I am meant to be a clinician, but I desire to also be a surgeon. And I think urology is one of those fields where you have lifelong relationships with your patients, where you can go in and out of the OR with it. And then lastly, I think there's a balance in like seriousness and playfulness. So they're the fun, quirky surgeons that are really relatable to people, but they're also very, very skilled in what they do. And so there's a certain level of respect around the field as well. And so if you're listening, I do hope you go into urology.
I think both really highlighted the wonderful aspects of the field and how they appeal to your interests. You mentioned a bit about some of the stereotypes surrounding urology, namely it being a very male-dominated field, caring for predominantly male patient populations. I'd love to hear more about what you think of these stereotypes in urology, and if you think there are any others that are important for our listeners to understand.
Yeah, I think if we're honest with ourselves, some stereotypes are true. I think it is a male-dominated field, and a majority of the patients you do see are male, just depending on whatever specialty you have done within urology. I'll take the time to say, I absolutely love being a female in urology. The patient population is part of the reason why I love it. It's some of the nicest men and women I have met in the hospital. I think to approach urological care, there's a certain level of humility patients have, and it's equally met with humility amongst the provider side, because it's such a vulnerable type of medicine. It takes a very special person, I think, to do it, who can really see someone in what could be a very stressful or heightened time and just calm them down and be like, I've seen everything before. You can trust me. You don't have too long to build rapport. So I think it takes a very tactful person to be the person in the room. Other stereotypes, I would say, and I say this in humor, we have the best penis jokes in the hospital. That's obviously true. We really have seen it all. I would say those are the main two ones. Like, you're fun and you're quirky and you're approachable.
You're approachable, no pun intended. That's awesome. Yeah, I remember not realizing until some part in medical school, second year, maybe even third year, that not all urological patients are males, and that a patient might need to see a urologist as a female. I think the media, medical education, lots of factors contribute to this. Have you noticed from your experience so far how patients, students, the public have fallen victim to such misconceptions?
Absolutely. I think my primary story was a classmate asking the residents why a woman would ever see a urologist. Why can't they go to OB-GYN? And for better or worse, the resident asked if we had done anatomy yet, which the answer was no. Part of the turf of urology is sometimes you're a little coarse with your jargon, but his answer was different holes, which is, you know, anatomically correct. And so I think we put a little too much emphasis on the penis and when we think about urology, but it's everything that has to do with the urinary system. So kidney, ureter, bladder, urethra, maybe a penis, maybe not. But it's, if anyone has to pee, they can see a urologist. And I think that's why I actually do love it, is you can specialize in anything you want. And so I personally am choosing between pediatric urology versus reconstructive urology versus infertility and sexual medicine. It's way too early for me to know, but I think even in that sentence, you truly could customize your practice to be anything that you want.
That's great. Yeah, I know from social media, the likes of Dr. Rachel Rubin, who I think has been a great example of how female patients can see urologists and female physicians can be urologists as well. I think sexual medicine is a specific aspect of urology that not a lot of people probably think is homed in urology. Like you mentioned, I think a lot of people just assume sexual medicine is the work of OBGYNs and that's it. But I like how you said, you know, if you can pee, you can see a urologist. And yeah, I mean, I would encourage any of our listeners who are interested in sexual medicine at large to consider urology.
I think I'll just take a second to say, I believe there's like a societal misconception and also a health system, maybe crack in the system, in which we have channels for men to get sexual medicine and care, and that's through urology. And that field is called men's health or andrology. But when you want to do female sexual medicine, your brain or the healthcare system algorithm defaults to OB-GYN. But at this moment in time, I don't think there are formal sexual medicine fellowships under OB-GYN. There might be one housed in San Diego, and I think anyone can do that course with Dr. Erwin Goldstein. But it's not per se like a de facto thing you can do within OB-GYN. And I would have to ask my OB-GYN colleagues if they feel comfortable within the realm of treating sexual medicine, but it's definitely understudied, underfunded, and unhoused. And it's like maybe UroGYN could do it, but it's kind of nor here nor there. And so in my ideal world, if I do sexual medicine, I would love to do full spectrum sexual medicine, which would be female and male, because I think there's a lot of things we can offer men who have sexual dysfunction. Maybe it's a prosthetic, maybe it's pharmacy, you name it. But if you give someone who is in a heterosexual couple a penile prosthesis, but you've never talked to the female partner about her hypoactive sexual desire disorder or her life post-menopause, you've only treated half the problem. And I think it takes two to tango in most cases. And so it's, I think, a disservice to the couple. And so I really look forward in my career to provide a full spectrum care for sexual medicine.
That's awesome. I'm wondering if at any point in your medical journey, were you considering two specialties?
This whole journey kind of started with UroGYN because I was trying to find that niche female population I could treat within urology. And so you can pursue UroGYN from either OB-GYN or urology. I think previously the years in fellowship would vary where it would be 3 for OB-GYN and 2 for urologist. I think it's since changed. I'm not perfectly positive on that. So I did consider OB-GYN for a very quick moment in time. But I found that the personalities, the work-life balance, the things outside of UroGYN itself within urology resonated more with my career aspirations. And so my thought was always to aim for the most competitive thing. And if that is what I do choose at the end of the day, at the end of third year, then I've set myself up for success. But if I do choose something else, then maybe it's all transitive in the end.
I think that's a great way of looking at it. Deciding on a specialty can be really difficult, I think, especially when one's interest in a specialty or specialties is united by a common theme that can be pursued through different specialties, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and I will say for our listeners, urology is just one of those fields. If you know earlier, the better, so you can set yourself up for success. I had known, at least to some degree since my first year, that I wanted to do research in the field and keep up with the department for the aforementioned reasons. But I also did take a research year in between my third year and my fourth year. And the logic was, if, you know, I did not match at the end of the class of 2023, which was my original class, I would do a research year regardless. And so for me personally, I felt like I didn't lose much doing that research year preemptively. Instead, I would set myself up for better success and only hopefully apply once. So if there are people who have questions about research years, I'm always open to answer anything for you.
Thank you. I was hoping to talk more about your research year. You mentioned your reasoning for doing it. Looking back, would you have made the same decision?
100%. I had the best year. So for our listeners, I did a research year at the University of Miami under Dr. Ramasamy, who is a andrologist, so a men's health and infertility specialist. I was one of three researchers he had for the year, and we all had different projects, but I worked within sexual medicine and wearable technology, and I did grant writing, IRB approval, execution of different studies, data collection, analysis, manuscript writing, on top of 2 days in the OR and 2 days in clinic. And so it was an extremely comprehensive year that I feel like prepared me very well for my fourth year as well as intern year, because I was able to operate for a year straight. And I think it's an opportunity that we don't even get as third or fourth years because it's so dissected with other requirements. And so I would do it again in a heartbeat.
That's awesome. How did you structure your fourth year for matching into urology once you came back to school from your research year?
This is a really excellent question because it's something I very much struggled with. So if I can help someone that comes after me, I would be more than happy to. Taking a research year is unique in that I was required to take step two prior to my research year. So technically, I took it when our classmates took it at the end of their third year and then took my year off, which essentially freed open a month in my fourth year. Coming back from a research year, I got a terrible lottery number, as we do in Loyola. And so I didn't have too much choice in my schedule. And I started with my sub-I ICU. It was really tough to start on that after your research year, but in hindsight, it taught me a lot of amazing medicine. It really threw me in the deep end. And now, as a second semester M4, I'm really happy that I do not have to do ICU again. But I did ICU followed by my home sub-I and then two aways, with my last away ending in October. I would not recommend that if that is not necessary. This is just how our schedule at Stritch is structured. So I couldn't start my fourth year before July. But if you're listening and your year starts earlier, the earlier the better.
What led you to do aways in urology? Are they necessary? Are they really important? You know, do most people do them? What should our listeners know about aways for urology?
I would say in urology, aways are almost kind of mandatory. I think it's very rare that I've heard someone not do a single away. I did two aways, but technically, you know, I would count my year at the University of Miami as kind of an audition as well. So I felt comfortable with two plus my home program. I know there are people who did three aways plus a home. It depends on your financial stretch, your time stretch, and your physical and emotional ability. I would say aways are really taxing. And I think what I learned the most, beyond how important they are, because those letters really go a long way depending on how you targeted them by region, I would say what I learned was go do an away where you have family or friends in the city. It cannot be understated that anything can go wrong at any time. And so it's just nice to know someone and maybe to save a couple $100 on rent by crashing on someone's couch. And so if I were able to do a ways again, maybe I would have changed the location to be closer to family. But I would highly recommend the listeners to do a ways, maybe regardless of specialty. You should just know how other health systems work. And maybe it makes you appreciate your home program more. Maybe it tells you you want something more academic or something more community. So as long as you have a spectrum and a reason as to why you're going to the place you're going, I would heavily recommend it.
That's really great advice. I am glad you mentioned the financial considerations, the physical, emotional considerations as well. I also think the financial considerations are often overlooked.
Absolutely. And that's not to say that you can't go somewhere you've never been. I did one at my alma mater in San Diego, and I did one in Boston, and I've only visited Boston once or twice in my life. And they each presented their own challenges. The fiscal challenges were equal in both. But I think it just depends on on your self-check-in and being honest with what you can handle, and then also being honest with the program at that point in time.
Yeah, definitely. What are your thoughts on letters of recommendations for urology? How did you go about thinking about yours? Did you get them from your aways? What did that look like?
I would say they're extremely important in the field of urology. We are such a small society of medicine that everyone kind of knows everyone. And so who and where you get your letter from, I think, has a heavy weight in your application evaluation. I got one from my research here from Dr. Ramasamy. I got one from our program director at Loyola, one from the chair at Loyola. And because my aways were later in the cycle, so one in September, one in October, I knew I could not get a letter from my October away. And that was something that I was just doing as like an in-person audition for them and for their consideration. But no one will know that I went to Boston on the application portal. And so then my fourth and final letter was from my first away at UC San Diego.
Thank you for pointing out the importance of the letters of recommendation.
The one thing I didn't say is, I alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I think I didn't realize that there's a geographical weight for where your letter is from. And so hypothetically, say you're doing an audition rotation with me at Ochsner next year, I think potentially it would open up the Southeast section of the AUA for you. So it would just signal that you are interested in the Southern part of the US. So I would take that into account if I was doing a ways again, like what part of the country am I very seriously targeting and what institution is the right level of academic versus community for me and things like that.
Thank you. Yeah, that's, I think, great advice as well. How does one go about choosing which urology residency programs to apply to?
That is actually a really good question and something that we were navigating with the help of our mentors this year. This was the first year urology did 30 signals. And so there was a lot of confusion on the weight of the signals and how to split up your 30. I was personally given the advice to split it into thirds. And so 10 programs that, you know, are your dream programs, maybe they're really high in caliber, maybe you're unsure of your fit for some regard, 10, which you feel like you would flourish at, and 10 that you would like be very comfortable and just do extremely well in, I would say, and you think are attainable for you. I applied to 22 more outside of the 30. I think I was under the average number of applications for this cycle. I still think it averaged in the 70s or 80s, but this is lower than previous years. And the whole point of the AUA and the Academic Board of Urology putting forward the signals is to lower the cost burden on applicants. So we're not going crazy applying to all 170 some programs, and with that we're intentionally thinking about where we want to put our application. Like I said, I applied to less than the average. And I think if I were to do the cycle again, I probably would have alleviated a lot of stress on myself if I had applied to more places. I just wasn't sure if it was a waste of my money to apply to places that I wasn't signaling. I don't think it is. And I feel comfortable saying this on the record. I don't know how high the accrual rate would be for you to get interviews for places that you have not signaled, but even one more interview, in my opinion, is worth it if you're going to count it up in the long run. And it's a game of probability and chance and matching. Your goal as an applicant should be to secure interviews, not to worry about like if I match at XYZ place. You can't match at XYZ place if you don't have an interview from XYZ place.
Definitely. I just want to point out for listeners who might not know this lingo yet, that signals are a way for applicants to demonstrate to a program that they're highly interested in that program. Different specialties have different rules about the signals. Internal medicine, for example, to which I applied, had 7 signals. No, for urology and more surgical specialties, it tends to end up, applicants are given much higher number of signals than 7 for internal medicine. And then beyond that, certain specialties have tiered layers. Some specialties have tiered signals, like dermatology, for example. We won't get into the weeds of that, but at the end of the day, signals are a way for an applicant to show their interest, among other ways. So I really liked how you mentioned that it's okay, if not important, to apply to programs, even if you're not signaling them, because you can show your interest in that program in other ways. Other ways could be networking with people at that institution, getting a letter from a physician who's connected to that institution and can advocate for you, things along those lines.
I would say the additional thing you can do, which I did not do, and so we can talk about both sides of it, is geographic preference, which is a section on ERAS, regardless of your match. So there was a lot of back and forth. I think this is the first year we've had geographic preference. I was given the advice, which I ultimately followed, to not put geographic preference. And I think that is why my interview spanned from coast to coast. I think my options were representative of my choice to not have a specific area in the country in mind. My friends who did signal or put a geographic preference of like West Coast, Midwest, East Coast, I think where they ultimately matched is within that geographic preference. And so it's totally up to you. If you have a limitation or a desire or a necessity, talk to your mentors about putting a geographic preference. If you are open to exploring a new part of the country, are not tied down in one way or another, are looking for flexibility, talk to your mentors about not putting a geographic preference. Again, I can only speak for urology. I have matched in the South, where I have seldom been, but look forward to going. And I'm not sure if the same would have happened if I had put geographic preferences, because I don't think I would have innately put that as my top 3 geographic locations.
Got it. I would love to switch gears now a bit and talk about advice in general you might have for students applying to urology. So what would you say is perhaps the most important piece of advice that you would give to medical students applying to urology?
I would say, do not underestimate the power of networking. Like I said, it's an extremely small field with around 300 new urologists every year. That being said, the field is not that big and everybody knows somebody. And it is such an inclusive, welcoming field that is looking to diversify, that's looking to grow. And if you have an innate reason and desire to join this field, all you have to do, I shouldn't say all you have to do quite a few things, but I think it would really serve you to network and put your name out there, email program directors, email administrative coordinators, set up meetings before you apply for away rotations. Just having a presence, whether it's social media, whether it's conference, or whether it's published research, having your name out there will go a really long way. Even after you secure interviews, it'll give you something to talk about. So for sure, make it known in your own way that you would like to join the field of urology.
That's wonderful advice. I know from following you on social media for several years that you've leveraged your identity on social media as well. And I think now more than ever, technology can be a very useful platform for networking and ultimately advancing one's career and application. So thank you for mentioning that.
Absolutely. I'll take a second to say, I actually got my research year from Twitter, from MedTwitter. So I know people are split on the involvement of social media in medicine. I, for one, think it is what you put into it. And so if you want to use it to connect with whatever affinity groups that you're in within your desired specialty, it's a great way to know what's happening and a great way to make colleagues before you actually have colleagues. And it would be silly to not take advantage of it if you can.
Definitely. What advice in general might you have for current medical students as they move through their training and consider different specialties, try to be the best potential applicant that they can be?
This is a little tangential to your question, but something I've been thinking a lot about now that I'm on the other side and that I'm engaging in these conversations a lot more. But I think med students have worked so hard and overcome so much. You've literally defied the odds and you've already made so many of your dreams come true by being here today, whatever year you are in med school. I think we continue to apply this, I have to prove it attitude, even when we pick our specialties. And so sometimes maybe we'll have a red flag, whether it's a step one score or a step one fail demarcation or remediation, whatever you have. Something I've been thinking a lot about recently is you actually should not do something to prove it to other people, because once you get to that peak or summit that you're trying to achieve, the main person that's there is you. And maybe if you want to prove it to yourself that you wanted to do it, I think by all means, then for sure. But if you're doing it to prove to others that were naysayers or deniers, I don't think that's enough of a reason to pursue a field. And it would probably need more introspection on your part about why you are doing something. And I say this because I really wanted to defy the odds and become a urologist, whether it's being a woman of color or whatever adversities I had in my past. I wanted to prove to people that I could do it. And it took time. I think it took upon me entering my research year that at some point in time, that's not enough of a reason. That's actually not the best reason to pursue a field or pursue anything, because you're not putting yourself at the center. You're putting other people at the center of this goal. And I would say I'm extremely fortunate that for all the aforementioned reasons, urology is the right field for me. It is everything I'm looking for and more. And I think I'm very fortunate that I happened to find this field while having this innate desire to prove myself to others. I was able to eventually put that away and be like, no, I actually just want to do it for me. It's okay if nobody's watching. It doesn't frankly matter. But as I look at younger medical students, I think we lose that introspection when we think of specialties. We think of competition and clout and all these things, but they frankly don't matter at the end of the day. Whatever you do, you should be happy doing for the next 40 years. And if you don't see yourself being happy, then I think I would ask you to go back to the drawing board and really look at what you're looking for.
That's really valuable advice, life advice in general. I think your points, could even be extended to beyond the decision-making of choosing a specialty, but especially in medicine, where our lives, our education are all so difficult emotionally, physically, of course, academically. There's too much at stake to do something that you're not going to be happy with.
And then the only thing I would add is it's okay to change your mind. It's okay if you change it in the middle of third year. It's frankly okay to change it whenever you want, if we're going to be honest. Probably not after you've signed the NRMP contract. I think there are some legalities that you cannot per se get out of, but I think it's okay to check in with yourself and to continue to check in with yourself, regardless of what stage you're at. I've had attendings tell me that they've completely swapped residencies in the middle. So as long as you are being honest with yourself at some point in your journey, I think I just wish you the best. And if you want to be a urologist, please reach out whenever.
Thank you. If listeners do want to get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to connect with you?
They can feel free to Twitter DM me. They can email me. I think I will be getting a new Ochsner email, which I do not have yet, but perhaps I can send to you once I do. But my Loyola email is always open as well.
Great. So I think now would be a great time to wrap up. Thank you so much for coming on the Medicus episode. It was really great talking, hearing about your success, your hard-earned wisdom. So thank you for taking the time to share it with our listeners.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode. This wouldn't be possible without the support from our listeners. Please rate, review, and subscribe. We appreciate donations to help fund the production of this podcast. To support us, go to medicuspodcast.com, where you can additionally find show notes, links, and information about our guests. We are at Medicus Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you have any questions, comments, or episode suggestions, please submit them on our website. This podcast is intended for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine. No patient-doctor relation is formed, and the content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Views and opinions are their own and do not represent any organization.